family should be happy, including father, mother, and children. Unfortunately, they often turn into battlegrounds. I'll return in a moment with the amazing facts about how to make wives happy. Hello, this is Joe Cruz on the Amazing Facts broadcast, facts which affect you. Listen, the American dream of true happiness has usually revolved around the ideal of a home and family. But that dream today is rapidly turning into a nightmare for millions of couples who are desperately trying to shake loose from their marriage vows. The problem of home instability is so serious that many sociologists believe that the family unit will soon disappear as a basis of American life. Now, whether they're correct or not, we have to face the fact that almost half of today's blissful brides and grooms will soon be battling to get back everything they promised each other at that wedding altar. A few years have brought incredible changes to the majority attitude toward marriage. Once, it was considered an eternal, life-linking contract for both parties as long as either one lived. And today, it's often looked on as a sort of experimental, revocable arrangement with very few strings attached. Now, without doubt, broken homes and divorce after effects are responsible for the great bulk of human misery in this world today. And it's more than coincidental that the freest nation in the world has the highest divorce rate of any country on the face of the earth. Now, it doesn't seem to make sense that the people with the widest possible choice of decision in this matter should also choose things that will bring the deepest misery for themselves. But is it really the way they choose, or does it have something to do with maturity and personal responsibility? Surely all the broken marriages can't be blamed on people choosing the wrong companions. Even in India, where parents have traditionally made the choice for their children, only a fraction of our marriage misery seems to exist over there. No, the problem lies deeper than poor taste in picking the right companion to marry. Although it must be conceded that 75% of teenagers are ready to throw in the towel on their marriage within about 5 years. But again, we need to ask whether it's a mistake of the emotions or a defect in basic maturity. In this message on the home, I want us to probe for the real secret of marital bliss. Multitudes of young couples are searching for those secrets right now. The honeymoon is over for them, and they're beginning to see the realities of human imperfection and the one they romantically consider to be almost without a flaw. Other couples who've been married for years have slipped into a monotonous toleration of each other, full of loneliness and frustration. Let's face the fact, friends, that much which is wrong with marriage today is based on a false mental attitude. Many entered that union with a distorted idea that if it didn't work for them, they could just very easily secure a divorce and shake loose from those marriage vows. And it's likely that millions of newlywed people today see no alternative to incompatibility than divorce. It's the magic escape that's always available if they don't like the new arrangement. And instead of seeking for more responsibility and some unselfish solutions, they take the simplest solution of retreat and divorce. Unfortunately, what they consider a simple escape often becomes an emotional trap of pain and trauma. Why should any couple consider the radical surgery of divorce for a marriage that might only be afflicted with a headache or touch of indigestion? A person doesn't get a lobotomy for a simple headache. Less drastic and more courageous alternatives need to be considered for ailing marriages, friends. And those alternatives are what we want to spotlight in this series on the radio today and in the next few days. The Bible is the greatest book on human problems and family problems available anywhere. You see, it lays down principles by which husbands and wives can play their true part in married happiness. Today, I'd like to focus on the husband and what he can do and what he can be in this ideal relationship of holy wedlock. One tremendous verse in 1 Peter 3:7 contains several principles of responsibility for a Christian husband. Listen to these words. Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. Now, friends, the first thing I want you to notice in this text is man's role of intelligent leadership. Peter says, "Dwell with your wives according to knowledge." Now, this means that every husband is responsible before God for what his home becomes. This corresponds to the rest of the Bible on the same subject. For example, Paul wrote that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. 1 Corinthians 11:3. Now, please notice that among all the levels of authority in the universe, God has set man in the place of leadership over his own home and family. And here we approach one of the most proverbial and devastating problems of the modern home. God never assigned women to be the heads of the homes. They were not made for that role. Neither do the majority of them really want it either. There are too many milquetoast men and bossy wives on the scene today, no doubt about it. But much of the problem is that husbands refuse to assume their responsibility in the family. Wives don't necessarily seek for the position, but it's forced on them through default of the husband to take his place at the head of that family. Now, this is not always the case, of course, but I'm talking essentially to the men in this message. As sad as it is, we must face the fact that men are not taught to be men in much of American society. Many men grow up and get married, but they're nothing more than little boys still, looking for mothers, really, rather than wives. Unless the man is willing to exert his leadership, his wife will be forced into an artificial and often unwilling role for which he's really not fitted. A mistake made by many men is to assume only a partial or lopsided leadership in the family. They can take very seriously their responsibility to make a living and be the breadwinner, but they casually cast all the rest of the home operations onto the wife. She's left with the final word about spiritual training of the children, for example, and establishing guidelines of discipline and family order. This is a cop-out for the husband, friends, and an absolute rejection of his primary position of authority within that family. Some wives may seem to battle for top place, but in the recesses of their minds, they really want their husbands to win out. It's a disappointment, in fact, to them when their husbands refuse to assert that final authority for which they were really created by God Himself. Now, I'm sure that statement will be challenged by those who subscribe to the modern feminist movement. Their dedication to equating the roles and responsibilities of men and women completely reverses the order set up by God in the beginning, who created male and female. Now, let's answer another question. Does this male authority assume that the husband can lord it over his wife and treat her as an object of possession or as an inferior? Absolutely not, friends. In fact, Peter's statement referred to here, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel. In fact, the entire biblical record is clear and harmonious on this fact. The man must love his wife as his own body. The creator of the female mind knew that she needed to feel loved and wanted more than anything else to have that. In fact, God made the woman with a nature that required love. In the Garden of Eden, the Creator indicated to the woman that her need for love could be satisfied most fully from her own husband. In fact, He said to her, "Your desire shall be unto your husband." Genesis 3:16. Now, that statement of God has been confirmed by every marriage researcher since time began. Psychologists unanimously agree that a woman must feel secure in her husband's affections. Because of the sensitive romantic nature with which woman was endowed by the Creator, her need for love and security are much stronger than the man's. Her self-esteem is vital to her happiness, and this largely depends on the way that her husband treats her. The man gets his self-esteem by being respected, but the woman gets hers from being loved. His contentment and security can be based on success in his profession or achieving financial goals. But the wife has only one source of self-esteem and security. She can cook a fabulous dinner, but it's gone in an hour, and the family may not even thank her for it. Her best performance of household duties are not recognized or respected by the community. She depends almost entirely on her man to provide that sense of fulfillment, confidence, and well-being. Now, this is the sense, I believe, in which Peter speaks of the wife as the weaker vessel. His love is a necessity for her to function as a complete person, And that husband must accept it as his divine assignment to make her feel loved and to honor her under all circumstances. The Bible requires the quality of that love to be the same as Christ's love for the church and equal to loving his own body. And his love for his wife must not be conditional. The command is, husbands, love your wives, not necessarily because they're lovable or when they're lovable. Now, right here, let's take note of one of the most devastating things that can happen in a marriage. When the husband is critical, sarcastic, or scornful toward his wife, he is attacking and destroying the very emotional foundation of her life. Nothing will disintegrate a marriage relationship any more quickly than this. Furthermore, wives are driven to wild frustration by the husband's lack of tender romantic attention. Most men are utterly satisfied to sit peacefully watching the football game after an amiable meal. To them, the romantic niceties are unnecessary. But not that way with the little women, friends. They yearn to be the special sweethearts of their men, to be loved and appreciated tenderly. Poll after poll has shown that one of their greatest sources of marital depression is, quote, a lack of romantic love. They can have all the material things in the world, including the most modern electronic gadgets and appliances, but their real need is to be loved. Now, since man's natural disposition is to avoid the soft and sentimental attentions, he has to determine to develop those things for his wife's sake. Unless he decides on it as a deliberate strategy, the tendency will be to show less and less loving concern for the things that mean the most to her. And undoubtedly, this is why so many, and I mean so very many, middle-aged marriages are frustrated by lack of communication. Both partners seem to know what's happening, but neither has any power to correct the course. The rift gets wider, and soon the marriage counselor is on the scene, trying to break through a 7-year-old man-made wall of indifference. I use the number 7 not because it's a number of perfection in the Bible, but because the average marriage in America lasts, believe it or not, only 7 years. It takes about that time for the early attentions to dry up, and the relationship turns then into an intolerable burden. Well, several years ago, a humorous magazine article traced the declining order of marriage under the height of bliss coming down to the humdrum of routine, and the article was entitled The 7 Ages of a Married Cold, and graphically depicted the husband's reaction to his wife's bad cold during their first 7 years of marriage. And this was the first year. Husband: sugar dumpling, I'm worried about my baby girl. You've got a bad sniffle. I'm putting you in the hospital for a general checkup and a good rest. That's first year. Second year: listen, darling, I don't like the sound of that cough, and I'm calling Doc Miller to rush right over here. Now, you go to bed like a good girl. Third year: maybe you better lie down, honey. Nothing like a little rest when you feel punk. I'll bring you something to eat. Fourth year: look, dear, be sensible. After you feed the kids and get the dishes washed, you better hit the sack. Fifth year: why don't you get yourself a couple of aspirin? Sixth year: if you just gargle or something instead of sitting around barking like a seal. Seventh year: for Pete's sake, stop sneezing. What you trying to do, give me pneumonia? Well, does that sound familiar, friends? Listen. And now, this is Joe Cruz saying goodbye for today.